He's been a journalist, a political commentator, a political strategist, senior advisor to the Indian Ministry of Information and Broadcasting, Kanchan Gupta. Welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Thank you.
You're actually the first guest on my podcast since the end of the cockroach protest that led to the resignation of India's education minister. Purely from an optics perspective, what kind of a message did these protests send out to the world?
There is no doubt that the protest by itself was not unexpected, but the manner in which it unfolded, 20th July onwards, that took the government by surprise, because that kind of sheer violence against the police using force to push back the protesters, that made the situation very sticky for government, and you couldn't turn your eyes away. Now, you said which led to the resignation of the education minister. Technically, the education minister resigned to ensure that the situation wouldn't get worse. And if you read his resignation letter, he gives the reasons why he resigned. So I wouldn't say that it's because these people held a gun to the government's head that the education minister resigned. But whatever be the interpretation, the fact is that there was a protest. And for the first time, there was a glimpse into the worldview or the mindscape of what I call the Gen Z generation. So what do these kids think about? How do they look at life? What are their many angsts? What do they worry about? And what angers them? Perhaps none of us, whether in government or not in government, we never looked at them very closely.
You know what I really want to ask you? The Gen Z protests in India. Do you think that there were any parallels with what had happened, say, in Bangladesh or Nepal?
No. I'll very quickly explain to you why. Mm-hmm. Our politics has been of a different variety. Our politics has been of an accommodative nature. Our politicians are very sharp. Don't forget that Mohandas Gandhi was one of the sharpest politicians India has produced. Back of their mind, they always have the more serious and the more informed among them. They have Gandhi in the back of their minds. They know when to step forward, they know when to stand still, and they know when to step back. Number two, we have a very layered society. So in a layered society like ours, that kind of change doesn't happen.
Okay.
Our young are politically too diverse. They are culturally too diverse. They are linguistically too diverse. And definitely there is no single religion holding them together. But what is there in common to those who believe in this is the civilizational inheritance which they have. And that is of being a people who are accommodative, who are inclusive, and who are not exclusionary.
Okay.
So whether you see in Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, wherever this has happened, the Arab countries, the so-called Arab Spring, it is because of the exclusionism of the elite, of the ruling class. It is because of the in-your-face corruption. Even corruption in India is very layered. So it's a different thing. I mean,
right.
So it won't work over here.
What about the media coverage of the cockroach Gen Z protests in India? On one hand, the local media was being criticized for being too soft, the Western media for being too celebratory. What is your take?
Well, there was nothing called a local media. I find it abhorrent that there should have been an attempt to malign mainstream media in such a gross manner as we saw happening over there at Jantar Mantar.
You mean the journalists getting heckled?
Journalists getting heckled, then this whole use of the term Godi media. Now, such terms were never hurled at the media earlier.
But you don't think the media is at fault here?
No, listen, I mean, I may agree with the editorial policy of a media house. I may disagree with it. I may agree with individuals. I may disagree with them. But I wouldn't ever go to the extent of labeling anybody Godi or... like, for instance, I never use the term anti-national. Because I don't think I have enough intelligence to judge someone's nationalist or non-nationalist credentials. So this kind of labeling and this kind of demonizing is bad. The so-called digital media took over the space over there. Television comes under some amount of accountability. Print definitely comes under a lot of accountability. But the digital media, there's no accountability at all. And that, I think, is not a very happy situation. And I'm okay with editorial perceptions or editorial interpretations. I'm even okay with agenda. But so long as that agenda is known to be agenda and not as some great journalism as it is being made out to be.
What about the Western media's coverage of these protests?
It's been ghastly, as usual. Someone today actually pointed out that the New York Times has till now carried only one story on the enormous protests happening in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, where more than 40 protesters have been killed by the Pakistani army. And they have carried 16 stories till now on the Jantar Mantar protest, various aspects of it, of course. So, this is something which always intrigues me, that there is some kind of a system in place which rewards the monsterization of India. And we saw this happening during the second phase of COVID, if you remember.
Yeah.
When, you know, that we burn our dead is not some great secret which was kept locked away from the world all these years.
Only if you don't know India enough, you would
burn our dead.
Yeah.
So there were actually drone videos of bodies being burned that were cited as how ghastly the situation is, that you have to burn and get rid of bodies. And all these people were then rewarded with the Pulitzer. But that's how it rolls. I mean, you can get away with it in India, but you cannot, there's a price to be paid.
But is that India's fault? Why? Why would this happen in India? Meaning, the COVID example you were giving, people were dying all over the world. But the Western media, the Western journalists, they would just hop around hospitals, inside hospitals, Indian hospitals.
But that is precisely, there's a disbalance between the way they look at the world. Like, they wouldn't ever show photos of their dead. They wouldn't even mention that they have run out of space to bury their dead. At least we were burning our dead and they didn't have space to bury their dead. And they were just stacking them up in meat trucks. I mean, how is it that we were worse off? Now, having said that, this is not something which is entirely new. And India has faced this problem again and again. India faced this problem with The Guardian. India faced this problem with the BBC. BBC had to be shut down over here. The Guardian correspondent was frock marched to what was then Safdarjung Airport and put on the first flight out. I mean, you know, you just could not deal with them because they were so intransigent in their operations over here.
Why does the Western media hate India?
You know, during the Cold War, a new information order emerged in the world. And all these media houses, whether they were public broadcasters or private media, they became instruments of governments. And all these institutions which were earlier set up, I mean, DW was set up to cater to Germans,
right,
not to Indians. Similarly, BBC was meant for Britain, and it was meant for British subjects or British citizens abroad. But during the Cold War, they chose to become instruments of state policy, and their audience therefore changed, and from domestic it became international. And now, of course, the story goes that because the domestic demand and audience and market is shrinking, they need new ones. Money is tight, so they are looking at India as a market, etc., etc. But that's really, I mean, it's fine with me. I mean, I don't care. But I think at some point, foreign media needs to also revisit its own ethical standards. It's I won't say morals, but at least ethical standards, and how each day they violate them. And how it ultimately hurts their own credibility. Even back home, nobody takes the New York Times seriously. Nobody takes BBC seriously. Nobody takes the Washington Post seriously. Mm-hmm. Look at, where are these papers? We have RT as an alt media now.
I have a question there. India's long complained about the coverage it gets in the Western media. So the UK has a BBC, Russia has RT, Australia has ABC. Why doesn't India have a platform? Of course, there's DD, but not to a level where India's voice can be heard on a global stage.
Doordarshan, Prasar Bharati is an autonomous body to be functioning on its own. But the fact that it is a state broadcaster remains a reality. In our idea or concept of a state broadcaster, the purposes of state broadcasting, the ideal audience for state broadcasting, and how to use these instruments remain defined in a certain manner. Those definitions are the traditional conservative definitions of any state broadcaster. But as I said, during the Cold War, government started using their state broadcasters. All these people then became a part of the Cold War information system. And therefore, their audience changed from the local to the foreign. And increasingly, they started focusing on that because there was greater individual interest in that. It was much more fun going and doing a story on the Vatican City by placing condoms over there and saying, see, this is the real. And then you get found out and you have egg on your face, but nothing happens.
Yeah.
I don't think Doordarshan would ever want to do it. Should it be doing it? I think, yes, Doordarshan and All India Radio should break free of those traditions.
When Operation Sindoor happened, India had to send delegations to different parts of the world to just convey what India's perspective and point of view was. If there was DD around the world and if people could just switch on and heard India's perspective, would that not make things like much easier?
Yes, but also no. My journey begins in 1982, and I have seen the fashioning and refashioning of the world information order, on how the White West controls the information order. And there is an inbuilt bias in it. A white man's paper will always carry greater clout than a black man's paper or a brown man's paper. That's a fact.
And, even today?
Even today it would carry.
But that's why
it is a reality.
That's my question. Why doesn't India do something about it?
I think it is happening now. And I think younger journalists are now, they feel more confident. Maybe my generation was not that confident of being able to take them on. But today they are.
You think the Gen Zs will take them on?
No, not even Gen Zs. I mean, you are there. Yeah. Everything doesn't have to devolve to Gen Z.
To Gen Zs, yeah, I get it.
I mean, they will at best be reinventing the wheel, but the wheel is being invented right now. You know, the kind of stuff which you are doing, the kind of stuff which other journalists are doing. And I think young women have shown greater courage in doing this.
But what about the other side? Journalists in India, they face UAPA. YouTubers have faced FIRs. Then there are X accounts being withheld on government orders. Do you think that criticism of the government is increasingly being mistaken for being anti-national?
This is a common misperception. I don't think you can show me, barring the odd case, where the union government, the central government, has actually filed cases against journalists. Mm-hmm. Under any part of the law. Everybody says that, oh, there is a squeeze on free press, there is a squeeze on free speech, that the press is being throttled, expression is being throttled, speech is being throttled. And you are saying all that sitting here in Delhi or in India, fearlessly, without any fear of any government action for saying this. Man, you don't know what it meant, what censorship means under Indian law.
Yeah.
Under Indian law, under Indian constitution, what censorship really means. Like, and my generation remembers it from the emergency years.
What do you think of the increasing presence of RT in the region? Do you think it balances the Western media coverage of South Asia to a certain extent?
First of all, I think RT should drop the use of the term South Asia. That is purely a State Department coinage. US State Department coinage, you should not use.
What should RT use then?
Indian subcontinent or whatever, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh or whatever, but not the South Asia bunk. While RT should do what is right in terms of journalistic ethics and values, I think so long as you avoid driving an agenda, it should grow. I mean, and please don't fall into this trap. White West media has this preachy, pontificating attitude.
Mm-hmm. RT doesn't do that. No.
So we know the best on how to run a democracy. Yeah. We know how best to do this. We know how best to do that. I think Desis hate that being preached to. You and I are Desis, so we don't like being preached to.
Not at all, no.
So I think that would hold for the masses. Mm-hmm. So you should avoid that.
Narendra Modi's Instagram video was taken down, after which India summoned representatives of Meta, of X, of Snapchat. What is going on?
Any big tech platform, whether it is YouTube, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, whatever, they enjoy what is called safe harbor protection. That means they are protected from penal action for anything that appears on their platform, provided they have not engineered it, provided they have no role in it.
Okay.
Now, when the platform intervenes in this manner, this is intervention in a country's political process, and it is unacceptable. And that is why these platforms were summoned by the Parliamentary Standing Committee, which is headed by Nishikant Dubey. And I think all of them came in, they trooped in, and they said they were very sorry that this happened. It won't happen again, etc. But rightly, they have been told, sorry, I mean, this is a violation of the safe harbor clause. in the IT Act. Mm-hmm. You can't just do it and say sorry. And now I think they have said that Mark Zuckerberg has to offer an apology, which I think he owes to the Prime Minister.
Exactly. Nishikant Dubey saying that Mark Zuckerberg owes an apology. And this was an attempt to discredit India. Where is this coming from?
See, you have to understand where it's coming from. The whole question is, what prevails? Does the law and sovereign rules of India prevail? Or do the boardroom rules of these big tech companies prevail? So just because Facebook decides that this is acceptable or this is not acceptable, does it mean that the government of India must also accept it? No.
Okay.
It has to be the other way around. A very quick point over here, which I would like to make. A lot of people, including sadly Indians, think that we have guaranteed absolute free speech in this country. We don't. We don't have free speech. What we have is conditional speech. People who talk about constitutionalism, they wave a copy of the Constitution and say, free speech is guaranteed here, please read it. My foot, you haven't read it. The first Constitution amendment in this country was done in the most unconstitutional manner. It was done by the Constituent Assembly, not even by an elected parliament. And it changed Ambedkar's clause of free speech into conditional speech.
You're a senior advisor to the Indian Ministry of Information and Broadcasting. We recently saw the Indian Prime Minister take to Instagram. He recorded that selfie video. Since then, we've seen parliamentarians talk in the Gen Z lingo. What is going on?
There are two parts to it. Mm-hmm. One is that you'll find many of them trying to ape the Gen Z, which I find comical. I mean, I cannot become a part of the Gen Z crowd. I can communicate with them, I can be with them, but yeah. I cannot be them.
Of course.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's an impossibility. Then there are politicians who think that it is good politics to connect with them. And we have to connect with them on their terms. Mm-hmm. I cannot expect them to connect with me on my terms. Mm-hmm. So then, therefore, you have the Prime Minister shooting his own videos, putting it out. I don't know whether he puts it out also, but he definitely shoots it. I know it for a fact. He, as a smart politician, he realizes that he needs to connect with them. And he is at an advantage. Look, man, I mean, in 2013, he was using Google to hold, what were they called now? Google Meets or something. So he was doing all this in 2011, 2012, 2013, when Gen Z was not even in its diapers. Mm-hmm. So let's not mock him for it.
By 2029, the next general elections in India, nearly 30% of the voters will be Gen Zs. Isn't Indian politics bound to change because of that then?
65% of India's population was 65 or 68% was 35 and below. So we are talking of a demographic profile which was never old. So if of that 68%, say a half percentage points are Gen Z, then it's a very good. I think it's very good that this churn is happening, that it brings with it a certain freshness. Every republic needs regeneration because otherwise republics decay. I mean, mm-hmm. history tells us that. Mm-hmm. So that the best way of regenerating a republic, of reaffirming nationhood, of reclaiming national identity, is to have new generations of people who are open to change, who think differently. So I would be very happy with it.
Vladimir Putin is coming to Delhi in September for the BRICS summit, and this is going to be his second visit in less than a year. Each time Mr. Modi and Mr. Putin are together, they're photographed together, the Western media has a meltdown. Why?
Again, you have to see it because the Cold War is over and done with. But that's what we think. But for them, the Cold War is still on.
Hmm.
So you are either with us or you are against us. This
yeah.
kind of a stark choice which they insist on exercising. You know, for instance, the coverage of the Ukrainian war. Now, I'm not going into the rights or wrongs of it, but the Russia-Ukraine conflict or Ukraine-Russia conflict, whichever way you want to phrase it, is not a black and white story as
yeah.
the Western media would insist it is. And again, there you are either with us or you are with Russia. Now, that kind of choice making, I don't think works anymore. And a lot of people may not want to talk about it. They may not want to get entangled with in long debates and discussions over it. But just like, you know, with China, the world has learned that it's best not to engage in an unending debate where you could be debating it till the cows come home. It's best to deal with China the way it is, and you figure out your own way, your own devices to mm-hmm. deal with China. So similarly, you know, the world will figure out a way and its own devices to deal with the West, and the White West media at some point or the other will find its influence declining.
My last question. Both India and Russia, they speak of building a multipolar world. What role can information and broadcasting play in turning that vision into reality?
I think a lot of countries now believe in a multipolar world. And the South definitely believes in a multipolar world. And this belief has only gained strength and ground after the COVID experience. When there was a lot of extreme bias and supply chains broke down, even multilateralism is now on a discount. So what you have instead are not grand global treaties, but working arrangements between some countries. So that is going to gain ground. And the more ground it gains, the stronger will be the global demand for a multilateral world, mm-hmm. and it will make it that much more possible.
Kanchan Gupta, what a wonderful conversation I've had with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.